The hardest part about doing a major project like this, believe it or not, is the very first day. Because there is so much introductory material regarding a book like Isaiah. There are actually, in the older days, there were actually whole courses just on the peripheral information surrounding Isaiah, particularly regarding the authorship and the unity of the book. But there really are. I mean, we could spend, you could have a whole course in seminary on just that issue. You imagine what you can do, you know, in a place like this. I think that would be superfluous for us. So what I want to do tonight, in whatever time we have, is to try to nail what I think are the very important things regarding introductory material. Just kind of hit the highlights of it, and then we'll move on to actually going through the book starting next week. But I think needless to say, what Beethoven is to music, what Shakespeare is in the realm of literature, what Spurgeon was among the Victorian preachers of England, that's what Isaiah is among the prophets. As a writer, basically he transcends, I think, every prophet that there is, all of his peers. I made an issue, a minor issue, last week about him just being a regular old guy. I think I misspoke on that one. He really had amazing ability as a writer. He had so many different nuances of expression. He was a genius, a literary genius. And the Holy Spirit used that personality and that ability to record this book, superintending exactly the way he wanted it to come out. And so it's fitting that the matchless contribution from this man's pen, which should really stand as the leader to all the rest of the prophetical books. It is the king of the of that genre. Anybody that has any sense of literary appreciation at all has to be impressed by the combined excellencies of Isaiah's style, the grandeur of it, the dignity of it. I was reading some Jewish Hebrew scholars, and they were saying, one of them even went so far as to say that of all the literature ever written anywhere in the world in any language, that Isaiah was arguably ranking up in the top three of all things that had ever been written as far as just pure literary beauty is concerned in the original language. So that really woke me up. I guess I wasn't aware of that. But the dignity of the book, the energy of it, the liveliness of it, the profusion of imagery, all kinds of imagery we're going to see, the vividness of its descriptions, unbelievable amounts of really fantastic and timely and appropriate plays on words. The plays on words, as I tried to show you a little bit of last week, are just phenomenal. The dramatic and the rhetorical touches and the variety, all the different, the poetry and the musical lyrics and the prose and the different, I mean, it's just an amazing thing, really, to even behold the book of Isaiah. Well, what I want to do tonight is touch the major item of introduction, and that is the unity of the book. That's the thing that was attacked the most, and I want to spend some time discussing it. There are several theories that the so-called higher critics that have been taught for a century or so, not as hypotheses, but nearly as fact. These are virtually taken for granted in many different circles. And among them are Moses did not write the Pentateuch. Daniel did not write the book of Daniel. In fact, he's been in the critics' den for forever. Peter did not write 2 Peter. And Paul probably did not write the pastoral epistles. And then last but not least, Isaiah wrote only part or the first part of the 66 chapters that constitute the book of Isaiah. All of these are accusations by unbelieving scholarship. Now, because Isaiah is such a major work, so replete with messianic prophecies, especially in the very parts that the critics attribute to other authors, and it's quoted so often in the New Testament, I think it's necessary to just spend a little extra time on this topic, the unity of Isaiah. And so the approach I'm going to take is, what I want to do is give the positive arguments for Isaiah's authorship of the entire book and then answer one by one the arguments that have been postulated against a single author. All right, number one. First of all, in favor of a single author, you have the witness of history and tradition. Until the late 1700s, virtually every Jewish and Christian scholar, without exception, considered Isaiah as one long prophecy by one very gifted writer. His name was Isaiah, the son of Amoz, as you can see there in verse 1. In the year 1795, you had an infamous man. His name was J.C. Doderline. Everybody that ever went to Bible college or seminary 50 to 100 years ago heard the name J.C. Doderline. He proposed a second Isaiah, also called Deutero-Isaiah, as the author of chapters 40 through 66. The book of Isaiah hardly anyone argues that the book consists of two separate compartments, chapters 1 through 39 and then chapters 40 through 66. And so this Deutero-Isaiah, or second Isaiah, is allegedly to be the second author. Of course, the difference in the content and the outlook between Isaiah, the first 39 chapters, and then the last 27, they've been noted by really all the careful readers that have ever taken notice of the book for centuries. But that doesn't necessitate a different author. It doesn't have to be a different author. In 1892, another infamous person named Doom, D-U-H-M, good name for him, Doom, D-O-O-M, he denied even the unity of chapters 40 through 68. And Doom then comes up with a third Isaiah, you see, or called Trito-Isaiah, for chapters 55 through 66. And some carried the thing even further, but two or three Isaiahs are generally accepted by all liberals. Anyone that doesn't believe in biblical inerrancy and infallibility or the doctrine of inspiration has no problem with two or three Isaiahs. No early tradition, though, ever suggested two or more authors. As a matter of fact, belief in the unity of Isaiah is early, it is uniform, and it had been unchallenged up until 1795. For millenniums, not just hundreds of years, for millenniums. All right. The second support for a unity of the book for one author is the witness of the New Testament. And this really trumps history and tradition. Isaiah is the second most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament. Anybody know what the first one is? What's the Psalms? Yes, the Psalms. And there's always an assumption of unity, always. Quotes from the second part of Isaiah as being by Isaiah are made by men like John the Baptist in Matthew 3 and Luke 3 and John 1. The apostle Matthew quotes the second half of Isaiah as being from Isaiah, and the apostle John, particularly in John 12, probably one of the greatest passages that would argue for the unity of the book. Also by Paul in Romans 9, verses 27 through 33, which we just recently finished. Paul's quotes there were from 2 Isaiah, and if you recall, if you were with us on Sunday evenings, he always says, "And Esaias saith," and he's quoting from that second part of the book. Okay, now this whole business is especially noteworthy in John 12, verses 38 through 41. Let's go ahead and turn there for a second, because this is really critical. If ever you're in a discussion with someone who wants to believe that there's two or three Isaiahs, this is where you take them. John 12, verses 38 through 41. And you go there because the actual author as a person, and not merely the book, is actually referred to. The man is referred to. Well, it would help if I got there, wouldn't it? John chapter 12. And verse 38. That the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake, Lord, who hath believed thy report, and to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? Now, where do you recognize that passage, right? Without even looking, where is he getting that from? Isaiah 53, that's in the second section, where the liberals say that a second man wrote that section. But here you have the Gospel of John attributing the statement to one Isaiah. All right, absolutely critical to acknowledge. Okay, and then notice verse 41. These things said Isaiah when he saw his glory, and spake of him. Okay. But these things is a reference to what? Again, Isaiah 53, in verse 1 in particular, which again is from the second part of the book of Isaiah. And then in verse 38, again, you have, in verses 39 and 40, therefore they could not believe, because that Isaiah saith again, he hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. And so that's from the first part of the book of Isaiah. So you have a quote there in the Gospel of John from both the second part of the book and the first part, and both parts are attributed to one person. And so that to me is a slam dunk. There's no need for any further discussion, actually. But I'll give you one more, and that is the unity of the plan and the development. Because the book of Isaiah displays a consistent plan and an order which absolutely does not go well with the theory of the statement that there's these collections of fragments by two or three or even more different authors. A fourth argument in favor of the unity of Isaiah is the sheer grandeur of the poetry. It's like I said, like this Hebrew scholar said, there's never been anything like it. The outstanding beauty, especially in the second part of the book, makes it absolutely very difficult to believe that such a fantastic writer that would have been alleged to live in the 500s B.C., hundreds of years afterward, could be completely forgotten. I mean, who is this mystery second writer? He writes so spectacularly and unbelievable. Somebody had to have known who he was, you see. So where is he? I mean, how come we forgot his name? Because it's Isaiah, that's why. And after all, the very short minor prophets are all described to their authors by name, just like Isaiah is. And then fifth, and this is a pretty strong, this argument is gaining weight, actually, and that is the Dead Sea Scrolls. When they found the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Qumran Cave 48, and you had an intact scroll of the Isaiah book, completely intact, that scroll gave no hint whatsoever that there had been any split prior to chapter 40. It was just all one run-on thing by the same guy. All right, so let's take a minute then and talk about arguments against Isaianic unity. Well, let's answer them. There's three main arguments. Actually, there's tons of arguments, but I'm going to give you the three main ones that are leveled against the book of Isaiah and its unity. And that is its historical viewpoint, the linguistic argument, and then the theological argument. All right, so let's look first of all in these arguments against Isaianic unity at the historical viewpoint. The fact that Isaiah falls into these two main sections is agreed upon by everybody. Liberal, conservative, it doesn't matter. Everybody basically agrees with that. And then you have chapters 36 through 39, which is often called the Hezekiah section. They're sort of a historical interlude there. And it's interesting how chapters 1 through 39 mirror the Old Testament, because how many books are there in the Old Testament? 39, right? And 40 to 66 parallel the New Testament because there's 27 chapters there. Is that a coincidence? You know, I mean, that may be coincidental, But since the chapter divisions are, particularly since the chapter divisions were done afterward, they're not part of the inspired text. But, I guess I'm coming to the point where I don't think anything is coincidental anymore. But the viewpoint of the first 39 chapters is definitely pre-exilic. They haven't been hauled off. At least Judah hasn't been hauled off yet. The north will be hauled off, and were hauled off, but Judah has not been. And the tenor or the viewpoint of the last 27 chapters is clearly post-exilic. So could Isaiah project himself into the future and write from a viewpoint in the future? Well, the unbelieving critics say absolutely no. They say no way. And yet, you have that all throughout the Old Testament. Jeremiah did that. Daniel did that. The Lord Jesus did that. What do you think the kingdom parables are in Matthew 13? You see. So if chapters 40 through 66 were written in the 500s B.C., like the liberals say, why is the flavor of the book Jewish? If it was written in the 500s, the flavor of the book should be Babylonian or even Median Persian. It shouldn't be Hebrew, you see. No way. Then there's the linguistic argument. What they say is that the style of the second Isaiah is different from that of Isaiah. That's what the critics maintain. And they all have noted the major break in outlook beginning with, maybe you don't even have to look, you already know. As chapter 40 opens, it's like coming out of a Texas tornado into the eye of the hurricane. Chapter 40 begins with, comfort ye my people. Whereas for the first 39 chapters, all God's just been whipping them, left and right. And so the transition is unmistakable about the tenor and the tone of what's happening. But that can just, that just simply proves the versatility of the writer, the skill of the writer, like any other skillful writer. Plato, Milton, Shakespeare, and others had tremendous ability to vary their writing styles. At the drop of a hat, they could do it. And they did it according to their content. But the glorious comfort of the Messiah that's prominent in those last 27 chapters is really enough to explain the difference, that God has a future for these people, and he's going to comfort them with that fact. Also, there's many similarities of style between the two or the alleged three parts of the book. There's many details that demand a knowledge of Hebrew, but one of Isaiah's phrases that shows up all throughout the work, you find this phrase in both sections, the Holy One of God, which points to a single author. Also, here I gave you a list. This column here shows the first 39 chapters, and this column here shows chapters 40 through 66. All right, and so what I want you to see, which we're not going to take time to look at these verses, but there is internal evidence. Internal evidence means in the book itself, all right, for the unity of Isaiah because of the similarity of passages that are found in both parts of the book. For example, in the very first one here, in chapter 1, verse 15, and then in chapter 59, verses 3 and 7, obviously two parts of the book, right? You have this repeated mention of hands that are full of blood, which points to a single author. Down here in chapter 2 and verse 3 and chapter 51 and verse 4, you have this imagery of information flowing out of Mount Zion, out of Jerusalem, that God would, the Bible says that God will teach us his ways and that a law will proceed out of that mountain, out of God's holy hill. You see, this profusion of knowledge coming from the headquarters of Jerusalem. You see, very similar language there in chapter 2 and in 51, and then in chapter 28, in verse 5, and also compared with 62:3, you have this phrase: "A crown of the Jews are going to be a crown of glory." and a diadem of beauty, you see, in both sections. Then in chapter 29, verses 18 and 42:7, you have reference to the deaf and the blind, that the deaf will be hearing, the blind will be seeing, and that'll be a wonderful thing. But again, you have the same similar statements in both sections of the book. Chapter 30, verse 26, compared with chapter 60, verse 19, talks about the diminishing of the lights, the sun losing its power, the moon being just as bright as the sun would in strength, and then eventually all the lights going out because God will be the light in that day. And then finally here, chapter 35, verse 6, compared with 41:18, you have references to the wilderness or to the desert and fountains beginning to gush out of the deserts and the wildernesses of the Holy Land, so that there would be vegetation and the desert blossoming like a rose. And so again, the point of this is that you have very, very similar, almost identical statements in both parts of the book of Isaiah. And then finally, there's their theological argument, which is a joke because they're not very theological. But the critics, to be fair, they do not suggest a contradiction between the theology of 1st and 2nd Isaiah. They just contend that 2nd Isaiah is more advanced. They think that guy was a better writer for some reason. And that fits in with the whole unsound theory of evolution, right? They have evolutionary minds. Everything is progressing. Whatever came later has to be better, you see. It's all part of their mindset, which they apply to everything, you see, and not merely just to biology. But Isaiah said to emphasize God's majesty, whereas the Deutero-Isaiah and the Trito-Isaiah emphasize more of his infinity, so to speak. Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah down in Judah. It was Micah and Isaiah basically working around the same time together. And Micah contains very, very similar ideas to the alleged second Isaiah. And so the theological argument is absolutely, by a mile, the weakest of the three for these gainsayers. But it does suggest the real reason for the theories in the first place, and that is that these people are bent on anti-supernaturalism. They're just like Thomas Jefferson. They do not believe in miracles. And that's really the whole issue. They refuse to acknowledge anything greater than themselves. And they'll point out how Isaiah mentioned Cyrus by name, you know, supposedly centuries before he was born, which is true. And you know, I mean, that has to be the case if you accept one Isaiah. It has to be the case. Josephus said that Cyrus himself was so impressed and so influenced by reading his own name there in Isaiah 45 that he actually let the people go. Now, I don't know how Josephus would know that, but that's his testimony. Many of the passages that are generally said to have been added are, interestingly enough, mostly specific prophecies that had been fulfilled. And so they don't believe in fulfilled prophecy, so they have to say, well, a guy came around 200 years later and wrote it down after the thing was fulfilled, you see. But there again, you have this anti-supernatural bias that is very evident in rejecting the early dating. Think about it. If God is omniscient, then he has absolutely no problem predicting the future, even though his prophets, in as great detail as he chooses. He can do that. So, in spite of all the inroads of these ridiculous theories that have made in supposedly Christian circles, the ancient, uniform, fundamentalist position is strong. And not only strong, it's logical. It's just logical. The entire book was written just like chapter 1, verse 1 says, okay, by Isaiah, the son of this man Amoz. And that's the bottom line. That's the end of the deal. But it's staggering. Now, friends, I probably gave you 2 years of information in 20 minutes on that. And I'm not giving you any more. But that's, you know, it was really a lot of time wasted, in my opinion. Now, let's talk about the man for a little bit here. Not many details are given or are known, really, about Isaiah's life. The ancient Jewish tradition that Isaiah's father, Amoz, that he was the brother of King Amaziah, it really has no historical foundation. There's lots of Jews that believe that. And the Jews do that. They make errors like that because they want to prop someone up, you see, and invent stuff to make somebody look better. But there's no historical foundation for that. What becomes obvious, or at least semi-apparent, is that Isaiah was a resident of Jerusalem and a member of a very prominent family at the time that he lived. We know that the prophet was married, and he actually calls his wife a prophetess in chapter 8 and verse 3. He had two sons that are mentioned by name, and we'll go over those guys when we get there, chapter 7, verse 3, and chapter 8, verse 1, 2, and 3. Just for the record, the name of the first one was Shear Jasup, which means a remnant shall return. And the second son was called Maher Shalal Hashbaz, hasten to the spoil, hurry to the prey. And so he's got these two sons, and they become, each one of them, living symbols of the twin themes that will be in the book of Isaiah, the book that Isaiah will author. Wrath against sin and mercy and redemption, you see. Now, we don't know whether the word prophetess would indicate that Isaiah's wife was what we might call a prophetess in her own right, or whether that was merely a title of honor. And both are possible. We know from the Old Testament that there actually were women in Israel that prophesied. Can you name any? What women prophesied in Israel? Can you name one? All right. Yeah. Deborah, Miriam, Huldah, right, and several others. But whatever the meaning of the term prophetess is in Isaiah 8:3, it's apparent that Isaiah's family was completely united and utterly dedicated to the service of God, and that their lives were subordinated to the prophetic vocation of the head of the house. And together, they stood as a living testimony to the truth that God had entrusted to this man. And Isaiah himself was, I think, very deeply conscious of this. You might want to notice the statement in chapter 8, verse 18. It says, "Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth on Mount Zion." Isaiah was very, very conscious of his purpose in life. It's very possible that Isaiah, who was very aware of the purpose of symbolism in names, that he may have seen in his own name, not a mere coincidence, but a divinely appointed significance. His name is really interesting in Hebrew. It's actually the precursor to Jesus. His name in Hebrew is Yesha Yahu. Yesha Yahu. And in abbreviated, it comes across as Yeshaya. Yeshaya. It's a composite name. And it means, actually, Jehovah is salvation. And if you study Old Testament personal names, fascinating thing to do, it shows that names, as a rule, were not given to children just to distinguish them from somebody else. They were given as a testimony to the faith and the hope that hopefully or supposedly was animating their parents, you see. And so the faith that was expressed in Isaiah's name was at the very heart of all of his prophecies. Salvation is in Jehovah. And it's interesting to note that the name Jesus, the Hebrew Yeshua, is a later variant of that same name. And Jesus also means Jehovah is salvation, or Jehovah saves. Matthew 1:21, call him Jehovah saves. But anyway, just like Elijah before him, and then John the Baptist later on, Isaiah normally wore a garment that would may have made him look like a typical Old Testament prophet. Probably a goat hair or sackcloth around his loins and simple sandals on his feet. That was the customary garment of a prophet. But at the Lord's command, and in order to drive home the point about the futility of certain things that were going on, like, for example, Judah's reliance on Egypt against the Assyrians. We know that Isaiah walked around, the Bible says, naked for a period of 3 years. Now, he wasn't totally naked. He wore essentially the equivalent of a loincloth. And when we get to chapter 20, I'll explain exactly what went on there. But no doubt the prophet's behavior had to have appeared to everybody that looked at him eccentric, to put it mildly, maybe even bizarre in the eyes of his contemporaries, just like we would view it today as bizarre. Surely most prophets were considered by their contemporaries as bizarre, if not just plain outright crazy. We know that some people contemptuously called the prophet Elijah, they called him Meshuggah, madman, in 2 Kings chapter 9. On the other hand, we also recognize that godly men like Obadiah would treat that very same man, that same man Elijah, with respect and deference, and Obadiah actually called him my Lord Elijah in 1 Kings 18:7. But regarding the birth and the death of Isaiah, the dates are a matter of conjecture. We don't have birthdays or death days for him. We can come to some conclusions based on the internal scriptural evidence. It's characteristic of the scriptures that the limelight is usually focused on the message rather than the messenger. The focus is usually on the prophecy itself and not the prophet. But it's only those personal details were mentioned which were considered essential for the understanding of the message. I guess what I'm saying is that there's no biographies in the Bible. The Gospels are not a biography of Jesus. There's no such thing, at least not in the modern sense of the world, of the word. Biblical personalities are, as a rule, they're presented as instruments in God's hand. Their purpose is to reveal his purposes or to help in the accomplishment of his purposes. And so they appear on the stage of history for a short time, and they do that for a God-appointed purpose, and then they disappear. But from verse 1 of Isaiah 1:1, I think that we can conclude that the prophet's ministry must have covered at least a part of the reign of Uzziah during the period of his leprosy and his separation when his son Jotham was co-regent and later on king. And all of Ahaz's and of Hezekiah's reigns. In fact, ancient tradition holds that Isaiah lived long enough to witness the early part of Manasseh's reign of terror, and that Isaiah was finally murdered by Manasseh. Put him in the hollow of a tree and sawed him in half. Jerome is the one that popularized that notion. Probably true. And so what I did here is I made up these dates. I didn't make them up. These are actual dates that show that the ministry of Isaiah spanned the five kings that are mentioned in, well, Manasseh's not mentioned, but the first four are up to Hezekiah. And tradition holds that that Isaiah was killed by Manasseh. All right, I was going to take the time to go over these dates, but we're out of time. We can't really do that. Let me just point a few more things out to you. In the great sixth chapter, I don't know why I'm getting ahead of myself here. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. That's generally accepted in chapter 6, verse 1, as the date of Isaiah's original call to the prophetic office and the beginning of his ministry. You say, well, how does that square with verse 1? You see, that immediately, right out of the block, we got a problem. It's really not a problem at all, but the assumption that Isaiah's ministry began in Isaiah 6:1 is unwarranted, and it actually contradicts verse 1 of chapter 1. You have an explicit statement of the vision that Isaiah saw, or was already, he was already an active prophet in the days of Uzziah, is what chapter 1, verse 1 says. He was already functioning. So that means that Isaiah 6 does not record the original call. What you have there is the man's reconsecration, if you want to call it that, maybe call it a rededication to his ministry, the prophetic ministry, after the death of Uzziah, you see, that he would continue on with these other kings. And the vision in the temple of this holy God in a time of national crisis results in the rededication of God's man as a messenger to Israel to warn them of impending disaster and doom, and also of the redemption that would await a repentant remnant. There's also numerous indications in the Old Testament that the prophets were usually called to their public ministry in their youth. And so it's therefore reasonable to assume that Isaiah was such at the time of Uzziah's death. Uzziah dies, you can see according to the chart, in 740 B.C. Okay, that would have made him he would have been somewhere between the ages then of, the oldest he could have been was between 25 and 30. All right, that would give us an approximate date for his birth around roughly 770 to 765 B.C., give or take a couple of years. And that's pretty accurate. And so what about the date of his death? That's a problem too. You have a strong clue relating to that matter provided in 2 Chronicles, chapter 32. And it says that, I'll just read it to you really quickly because we're running out of time. It says, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his godliness, his kindly acts, behold, they're written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, and in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. Now, that statement would indicate that Isaiah outlived Hezekiah, who died in 687 B.C., and recorded his life, his goodness, his kindly acts, in a book called The Vision of Isaiah that was later included in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. So you have the closing years of Isaiah's life are then brought to the reign of the wicked king Manasseh in 687 down to 642. So that brings up the question of how long did Isaiah live? And so both Jewish and Christian tradition assumes that Isaiah died the martyr's death at the hands of Manasseh. People don't immediately dismiss Jerome's postulation that Manasseh sawed him in half, because 2 Kings 21 verse 16 says, moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he filled Jerusalem from one end to another. And Isaiah was alive at that time, and Manasseh would have gone after anyone that would have challenged him. At the top of that list would have been Isaiah. So based on 2 Kings 21, it's not hard to imagine that Isaiah would have suffered this death. Jerome actually took the statement in Hebrews 11:37 that says that some were sawn asunder, and he's the one that applied that to Isaiah's death. And if credence is to be given to the tradition that Isaiah lived to the year to age 92, seven of which were under the reign of Manasseh, that would give us a date for his death around the year 680 B.C. So, both on the basis of internal scriptural evidence and on ancient tradition, that seemed to be substantial harmony with each other, we arrive at an approximate lifespan of some 90 years, which would be old for a Jew in that day. Very old. Covered between roughly 770 B.C. down to 680 B.C. Long, long life. So we have these chronological references there in verse 1, and they apparently apply only to the years of the prophet's public life, and they don't include the years of his semi-retirement under Manasseh, when Isaiah, because of undoubtedly his advanced age, probably confined himself to the house, or maybe just to writing. A lot of conservative scholars, like big name conservatives that came out and battled the liberals in that day, like Hengstenberg and Alexander and Edward Young, they believe that during that period, Isaiah wrote the second part of the book at the end of his life, chapters 40 through 66. And he did that in anticipation of the Babylonian exile and Israel's future deliverance. In addition to his prophetic activities, Isaiah was apparently also a prominent historian. In 2 Chronicles 26:22, it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, first and last, did Isaiah the prophet, son of Amoz, write." So he was a historian. So, in addition to that monograph about King Uzziah, there was also another historical work by Isaiah dealing with the life of Hezekiah. And that apparently contains some prophecies, because in 2 Chronicles 32:32, again, that same passage, that book is referred to as the Vision of Isaiah. Both of those works are lost. No one's ever found them. Nobody knows where they are. It's not a mission for Indiana Jones to go find them. They just don't exist anymore. It's possible that the most important events and prophecies contained in those two works were probably incorporated within the two books of the Chronicles and in Isaiah chapters 36 through 39, which is really all about Hezekiah. All right, so much more we could say. You can't believe how much more we could say. But I'm not saying no more. All right, we'll start with the line by line next week. That's a good enough introduction for what we wanted to accomplish.